Well, there are scholars who say there is an Islamic economy, and that is capitalism.
Right. Yeah.
And I agree with those.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Mustafa Akyol. He writes for the New York Times, and he's also a visiting professor at the Freedom Project of Wellesley College. Mustafa, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, it's my pleasure.
Okay, we are at the International Students for Liberty Conference, so we'll get to questions about international students and liberty. But first, let's talk about your two books. Islam Without Extremes. What is, you know, make the basic case there, and do you see, since it's been published, is that argument gaining ground among Muslims?
Yeah, that book, Islam Without Extremes, actually had the subtitle, which explains it, which reads, A Muslim Case for Liberty. Mm-hmm. And basically in that book, I tried to criticize all the authoritarianism I see in Islamic countries, within Islamic teachings, things like banning blasphemy or apostasy or forcing people to do certain practices. And I argued against those, again, from within Islamic grounds.
Because these are, I mean, there are, just as there are many, I wouldn't even say there are many versions of Christianity, even within a single organization like the Roman Catholic Church, there are many different Catholicisms.
Exactly.
There is no reason for Islam to be authoritarian on any level, right? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, that's my argument. And we have both, when you look into the Quran, you have certain verses that really vindicate human freedom, that declares there should be no compulsion in religion. Mm-hmm. But there are other verses, you know, some medieval scholars abrogated the liberal verses with the other ones, thinking that, you know, they are creating a more pious society by using authority. And when you look at Islamic thought, there are really interesting medieval Islamic currents that emphasize liberal values such as reason, such as individual choice, such as pluralism.
Yeah, well, talk a little bit about that, because this is one of the questions you hear, and particularly in America now, you hear a lot about people saying, well, Islam is not like every other religion, you know, because Islam is fundamentally incompatible with a secular, pluralistic society. Is there any reason to think that that's true?
I mean, the current state of affairs in the Muslim world can give that pessimism, saying that, wow, there is very little freedom in this world, which is true, and that's why I'm arguing against it. But what Islam can be, what Islam was in the past, is a different discussion. Interestingly, the same argument was made about Judaism in the 18th century when Jewish reformers like Moses Mendelssohn were arguing that Judaism is actually compatible with freedom of religion. People like Immanuel Kant were saying, no, Judaism is a religion of the law. It has rigid laws. Unlike Christianity, it's not the religion of the spirit. It can never adopt a free society. But actually, Jews, there was a Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah, and Jews dealt with very similar issues. And now you have many Jews living in the West as defenders of a free society.
So is the authoritarian Islam, or the turn to authoritarianism in Islamic countries, is that, first off, is it mostly geographical? Are those types of countries actually rooted in the Middle East or in North Africa? And is it fundamentally a modern development? Is it coming out of the writings of whether it's somebody like Qutb or, many of the things that the Catholic Church, for instance, in the mid-1900s, had the First Vatican Council, which rejected modernity, and it actually tried to go back to a false version that they said was traditional Catholicism that was against capitalism, against against modernity, against women's rights, and things like that. I mean, is authoritarian Islam actually
even a modern problem?
Yeah, is it? It's a modern development.
It has been exacerbated by modernity, but by an authoritarian version of modernity.
Right.
I mean, there are things like apostates should be killed in medieval texts too.
Sure.
So I'm dealing with those. And so I can't say medieval Muslim societies were liberal in the sense we understand today. There were some liberal, maybe proto-liberal currents, and I'm trying to revive those.
Right.
But what happened in the modern era is that that tradition got worse because it combined with the modern state, mm-hmm. which was a very centralized, you know, hierarchical institution. Right. I mean, people like Sayyid Qutb, their name yep. referred, he's known as the father of, you know, this fundamentalist current we have today. He basically took a lot of things from Islamic tradition, but combined them with a fascist state.
Right.
That was the Arab state, by yep. the way. Even secular Arabs right. actually admired that.
Right.
So.
Well, and then he ultimately was executed by Abdel Nasser, right?
Yeah, he was executed by an Arab dictator.
Yeah, who was taking that and creating a kind of pan-Arab mentality. Yeah.
The problem is, I think, when the state is by definition a leviathan, mm-hmm. different groups try to capture it, mm-hmm. and Islamists try to capture it by Islamic arguments.
Right.
Hence, you had this synthesis. Is called Islamism. It became a political ideology. But they brought authoritarianism sometimes from tradition, but they also admired, I mean, fascism. They said, right. I mean, Mevdudi, Pakistani scholar, mm-hmm. who's also one of the godfathers of Islamism,
right.
he admired the fascist model. He said, they just have the wrong idea in this state. We will put Islam mm-hmm. into it. So he got this modern authoritarianism and combined with that. So in my book, I try to untackle all right. these problems and say, well, here's how we can re-understand Islam, free from some of the burdens of the tradition, but also free from this modern right. authoritarianism, which doesn't have to be the only way of modernity.
Two questions, one quick and then one a little bit longer. So what about Islam as it's practiced, say, in Indonesia and Malaysia? Would a Muslim from Turkey or from Algeria, would they recognize if they were in a mosque in Malaysia or in Indonesia?
They would recognize, but also they would be surprised with the difference of culture. They would mm-hmm. be surprised with, I mean, the practices would be mostly similar,
right.
but I mean, you can go to Africa, like you can see Muslim women wearing a cloth that, you know, her belly is open, for example, which
right.
is, wow, so, you know, unthinkable for someone coming from the Gulf area, let's say. Or like covering the face, mm-hmm. that is the norm in Saudi Arabia. From Turkey, when you look at from the Balkans, even the most conservative mm-hmm. woman just wear a headscarf,
right.
covering the face is too much. So
yeah.
there are different variations. And the Islamic world is so diverse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and opinions are diverse. Like
right.
if people are asked, should we really stone people for adultery? Like 70% Pakistanis say yes. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is a Muslim nation
right.
in the middle of the Balkans, the people who say yes to this is 0.2%,
right.
according to Pew Research
now,
study.
Do you
so this is the diversity we have.
Does that mean that Pakistan has a bigger lobby for stone builders or something, that stone makers? So, which goes to my second question about kind of capitalism or free enterprise. You hear a lot about how Islamic kind of, and I realize that they don't exist, but the concept of Islamic economics, and say there are prohibitions on the charging of interest or all sorts of things, that this makes it impossible for a Muslim country to have a thriving modern economy.
Mm-hmm.
Are those, is that, those sets of laws, are they of relatively recent origin, or are they just so widely ignored
mm-hmm.
That you can have a functioning free enterprise mm-hmm. economy in, mm-hmm. in a Muslim country?
Well, there are scholars who say there is an Islamic economy, and that is capitalism.
Right. Yeah.
And I agree with those.
Yeah.
And because when you look at the history of Islamic civilization, you see that Islam was born as a very trade-friendly religion.
Right.
Prophet Muhammad was a merchant himself.
Right. Yeah.
So he has sayings, you know, venerating trade.
Mm-hmm.
When he was asked to regulate prices in Medina, he has a famous saying.
Yeah.
He says, I don't regulate prices, God regulates them.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, some capitalist-minded Muslims see
yeah,
a freehand ideology.
I think that's how we got the Federal Reserve. So I'm not,
yeah,
know.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
U.S. system is very complicated. I'm not going to comment on that. But so there is a tradition of Islam that actually values enterprise
right.
and trade and free trade. And Ibn Khaldun, the great Muslim sociologist of the Middle Ages, he actually wrote that a state becomes wealthier if there is less tax and if
mm-hmm.
the state is less involved in
right.
the economy. So we have that tradition.
Yeah.
That tradition had a few roadblocks. One is the ban on interest, as mm-hmm. you said. And some Muslims are rigid about that. But
right.
others, including myself, would say, well, what is really condemned in the Quran is usury,
right.
whereas, which is modern, different than irrational modern
right.
banking interests. And that there's...
And it's, you know, it's fascinating just sitting here talking about this, because all of these arguments and all of these developments have exact analogs in Western, in Christendom, because this is, John Milton's father was a usurer, or that's why Jews were moneylenders, because Catholics weren't allowed, etc. It would be before we start talking about the book about Jesus, the way that Islam views Jesus, I mean, why don't we get in the United States, or what has to happen to get a broader sense that Islam is not one thing, and that one thing is Muhammad Atta flying into the World Trade Centers?
Well, what made those people, 9/11 terrorists or other terrorists, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, definitive is that they create a shock and they make the news.
Right.
So people hear these people, horrible terrorists, and they shape an image of Islam, which is very unfair. I mean, yes, they are a big threat. We should not be naive about threat coming from ISIS, Al-Qaeda. By the way, that threat is coming to us, too. I mean, Istanbul was bombed by ISIS three times in the just past 2 years.
Syria, virtually all of the deaths are Muslims.
Muslims themselves. And, I mean, the people who fight them are also Muslims on the ground. So this is a very small extremist fanatical strain within Islam, which should be fought, which should be, taken into consideration for sure. But to extrapolate that to all Muslims and to say this is what Islam probably is would be the biggest mistake to do.
Is there a deeper kind of logic there when you think about a place like Europe, a space like Europe? Europe as a concept kind of defined itself for centuries as the non-Turk. It was like the Turk at the door. We are holding off the Turk. And by extension, I think a lot of American culture, English culture, and whatnot, also sees Islam. There's the Crusades. And even though most Americans know nothing about Islam, but they know kind of like the way we used to be against the Soviets. Well, we've always been against Islam. Does that play into it? And is that would be probably a harder nut to crack, right, in terms of engaging, re-engaging without this, millennial-long kind of twilight struggle?
Well, first of all, I mean, very good point you're making. Yes, there is a, let's say, geopolitical tension between, let's say, the Orient and the Occident.
Right, yeah.
And the Occident happens to be, it's defined by Christianity and the Orient defined by Islam. The Orient was defined by Eastern Christianity too, so it's actually a geographical thing.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily a religious thing. On the other hand, you have other episodes. You have in medieval Spain a culture of convivencia where Muslims, Jews, and Christians were together.
Right.
Muslims were ruling class, but Jews prospered, and it's the best time Jews ever had actually until the modern era of full emancipation.
That's the Catholics. They're still mad, right? Because they kicked the Moors out and then they made the Jews convert.
The Jews who fled from the Catholics came to the Ottoman Empire. Yeah. That's why we have a Sephardic community still in Istanbul who were escaping the Inquisition. Yeah. So it was not that by definition Muslims were the illiberal ones.
Right.
It was actually quite the opposite.
Yeah, totally.
That's one thing. The other thing is that sometimes, in that even that combat, like conflict history, you have corporations. I mean, Ottoman Empire and the French and the Brits went to war against Russia in the famous Crimean War, for example.
Right.
And we still have traces of that in Istanbul. Yeah. There's a Florence Nightingale Hospital coming from the British, taking care of patients and all that. So the history is not black and white, but we tend to see it that way.
Sure.
It sometimes helps us to see that way, but we should see all that nuance.
Let's talk, that's so fascinating, and it's great to think about now where are the places of nice negotiated interactions between Muslims and Christians or Western and Eastern countries, however you want to talk about it. But let's talk about your book about Jesus and how Jesus is presented in Islamic theology. And I mean, so he is one of, for Christianity, he's the beginning and end, basically. In Islam, he is one of several prophets. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? I mean, his actual status?
Indeed. Yeah, you're referring to my new book, and thank you for that, Islamic Jesus, which came out a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is How the King of the Jews Became a Prophet of the Muslims.
Right.
So basically in the book, I am showing what Islam teaches about Jesus, how it differs from mainstream Christianity, but it actually resonates with some heretical sects in early Christianity, some apocryphal gospels.
Yeah.
And there are very intriguing connections.
Yeah.
And you can understand them from whatever theology you're looking. And you can say, oh, one of our heresies influenced the origins of Islam.
Yeah.
Muslims can say our beliefs were already there within Christianity.
Right.
So they can see it as a vindication. I'm not taking a side. So, but I'm also going against some of the biases of Muslims against Christians and Christians against Muslims. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the Quran generally is against the concept son of God. It mm-hmm. is actually a denounced concept, and of course, how that is Jesus is defined in Christianity. Right. But when you read the Quran carefully, you see something. The Quran is actually condemning Arab notions, Arab polytheism, where you have a father and a wife and a son and a child, and you have sexual relationship mm-hmm. between. So it's condemning a carnal deity uh-huh. with a family, which was the Arab pagan notions, right. which was prevalent at the time, which is not exactly what Christians obviously believe right. when they speak of yeah. Jesus. So maybe Muslims can be a bit more understanding to the concept of Son of God when right. Christians use that. So that's, for example, one perspective I bring. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to bridge the theologies yeah. a little bit. Finally, I have a chapter which I think may gather some interest, titled What Jesus Can Teach Muslims Today. Mm-hmm. And there I'm saying to fellow Muslims, hey, listen, okay, we don't think Jesus is Son of God, of course, right. like Christians. We see it as a prophet, like mm-hmm. one of the greatest prophets, like Moses, Abraham, a figure like that. But then what do we learn from Jesus? What does Jesus tell us today? Yeah. We should still think. And there I say, what Jesus says to fellow Jews at the time, of his yeah. time, is a message that we need today. Because he criticized Jews for being of his time, and the Pharisees especially. Right. He was Jewish himself too. To be too legalistic, mm-hmm. to just be very obsessed about the minor details of the law, right. religious law, the halakha, but forgetting some moral principles right. behind it. You know, he opposed the stoning of a woman, you know, right. saying the one without the sin should right. Cast the first stone. Well, that kind of perspective is needed, I'm saying, with us Muslims today, because we have a Pharisee-like attitude.
Right, and so this is like in one of the parables where, a person doesn't help somebody whose donkey has fallen into a ditch because it's a Sabbath.
It's a Sabbath.
And Jesus is like, what is wrong with you? Of course you would do that.
Of course we should do that. And he says the Sabbath is made for... the Sabbath is made for men, not men made for the Sabbath. And I have a line, I'm saying the Sharia is made for men, not right. men for the Sharia. So Islamic law should not be something that mm-hmm. oppresses us. It should be something that protects us from evil,
protects us from insecurity. Is there something that is an analog of kind of the golden rule of do unto others as you would have them do unto you, so that you're replacing a long list of particular things, don't do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this, with that kind of principle? Is there an Islamic principle that kind of would move from a very rule-bound, literal set of implications to a kind of more principle-based?
There is. Actually, I mean, besides the discussion on Jesus, there is a tradition in Islam called maqasid, which means intentions. Mm-hmm. So this was emphasized by medieval scholars like Imam Shatibi, who lived in Spain, by the way, the mm-hmm. Bright spot there. And he said, he looked into Islamic law and he said, all Islamic law actually is about protecting five values. And he lists them as protection of religion, life, property, intellect, and lineage. Hmm. Now, some modern Muslim thinkers say, if you look at these five values, today they are better protected in Canada than in Saudi Arabia or Iran. Yeah. So Islamic intentions mm-hmm. are something. So there's a big gap there between an intention-based approach. So that is there. I think Jesus emphasizes most powerfully in the history of world's religions. Mm-hmm. And I think, therefore, I refer to that maqasid, that intention tradition in Islam. And I'm just also bringing a perspective from Jesus as a prophet of Islam, as Muslims believe, who really emphasizes this issue in a very inspiring way. So let's look at him and get an inspiration for some reform and change in our Muslim societies.
Here's a final question for you. As a lot of people in the U.S. keep saying, you know, what Islam needs is a reformation. And obviously, Islam has actually gone through various reformations, including some that brought it to its current point. Apart from that, or regardless of that, if a major Islamist country, say Iran or Saudi Arabia, actually falls from within, from a popular revolution that kind of pulls it down, is that the type of thing that might jumpstart a wider discussion within Islam, and also, from non-Islamic countries where we can start to re-engage on a more mm-hmm. fruitful mm-hmm. Level? Mm-hmm.
I think those comparisons between Islam and Protestant Reformation mm-hmm. are not right to the point.
Right.
Because the Protestant Reformation was a revolt against a centralized Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. In Islam, we don't have that.
Right.
We actually have a very decentralized scene. That's why that comparison doesn't always hold. Mm-hmm. What we need is the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. Not the Protestant Reformation.
Right.
But
right.
Not Luther, but John Locke.
Right.
John Stuart Mill. You know, that kind of Enlightenment tradition that brought reason and freedom to the table. And which was not hostile to Christianity. I mean, some aspects of Enlightenment were. But, for example, John Locke wasn't. He, quite the contrary, reinterpreted Christianity.
Yeah. And Isaac Newton wrote more about the Book of Revelation than he did
about
physics.
Isaac Newton thought, you know, Book of Nature, Book of God, so they're compatible. Yeah. So the thing is, we have those efforts.
Yeah.
We have, you know, efforts towards an Islamic Enlightenment here and there. In Malaysia, there are this progressive group. Mm-hmm. In Indonesia, there's this. Among Arabs, there is this. So, and I personally am connected, and I know these people. And so there is an effort. It's just it's a big battle.
Yeah. You know,
it's not going to be won overnight. I mean, John Locke made some liberal arguments, which looked too wishy-washy for many Christians at the time. Yeah. They won the day, but it took a long time.
And he was coming after 100 years of, you know, physical fights about the same thing.
Exactly. And so, after very painful lessons, some Christians came to those, I think. Yeah. Good solutions, and I think we are going through those pains in Islam today.
Do you think if a country like Saudi Arabia, you know, which you know is kind of in a precarious place, or Iran, there's always a lot of tumult and possibilities coming out of there. If one of them collapses, and not from a CIA coup, and not from you know Donald Trump making America great again, would that be helpful to discussions about Islam and its role in kind of the modern world?
It may or it may not. I mean, the political changes do not necessarily change the theology right away. I mean, collapse of Saudi Arabia can. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Saudi regime or Iran for sure. But it can lead to disintegration and some civil war, and that you will have a different problem.
Right.
For example, the Assad regime was a tyranny, and now you have in Syria is maybe even worse than what was before. So this idea that you should change the political structure and ultimately it will influence religious views is not always, I think, relevant. You should have good models and examples. Tunisia is one, for example. Yeah. I would speak of Turkey in the past, but unfortunately I'm not referring to Turkey that much anymore as a great example for complicated reasons. You have Tunisia in the Arab world as a country where you have the Islamists and secularists agreeing on a basically liberal framework, a constitution, for example. So, and I mean, authoritarian regimes are a problem in themselves. When they collapse, that can trigger something good, that can trigger a chaos and civil war as well. What is, though, maybe happening is that in Iraq and Syria, there's obviously a sectarian civil war today. And just people are killing each other because they're Sunni or Shia.
Right.
And some I think, wiser Islamic thinkers in Turkey have been saying that maybe that's why secularism is needed.
Yeah.
Because secularism came as a Western import, it was refused by most, you know, pious religious conservatives. But now they see, to capture the state, Sunnis and Shia are killing each other. Maybe we need a secular state precisely to avoid problems like this, disasters like this. And that's how Christians came to the solution of a secular state, basically. So I think we are going through some processes that Christianity went through. Jewish Enlightenment is, I think, very important, because I see more similarities between Judaism and Islam in terms of being law-based religions. And I think Islam is in a place that these other the Judeo-Christian, you know, sisters of Islam were a few centuries before. And there's no reason to say that, you know, it will be always like this. And I think we are in a crisis at the end of which better understandings of Islam may emerge. And I'm personally trying to push for that.
Good. Well, we will leave it there. We have been talking with Mustafa Akyol. He writes for the New York Times. He's also a visiting professor at the Freedom Project of Wellesley College. Your most recent book is The Islamic Jesus.
Yeah.
So that, which sounds fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.